Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us on the program. We're coming your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time. We stream live at richarddugan.com, and we also rebroadcast this program on A2Zen.fm, as well as we archive these programs. So we encourage you to check out all the opportunities available to you as far as getting the information from our guests. I think that you will find that most all of our guests have some very fascinating information to provided to you, and we certainly encourage you to check out all the good stuff. Well, we're coming to you, and it is 2013, and we made it through 2012 on December 21st. I told you, you need to listen to me. We survived. There was no catastrophic event that took place, at least not in my life. And I'm very happy about that. Needless to say, folks are now looking to the future, looking with optimistic eyes, I think, as to what's coming next. We don't know. I mean, there are those who now will speculate, and somebody will come up with another date for us to look forward to. Maybe you heard the interview with Diana Cooper and 2032 and the new Renaissance, the new age of peace and of building our civilization up. And I'm hoping that, you know, I'm looking to live to 2060, folks, to make it to 100 plus. So I'm looking forward to that particular period of time as well. But I'm looking forward to this period of time where you and I are right now, because we have on the phones with us our special guest for the program today. His name is William Whitecloud from Australia, and he has written a very interesting book. He's written a number of books, as a matter of fact, best-selling author of The Magician's Way, which helped to launch his latest book, The Last Shaman. And William, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program today. It's great to have you with us.
Oh, thank you, Richard. Thanks for having me, and a hello to you and everyone listening.
You know, the title alone, because shamanism is something that a lot of folks are intrigued by, and I know that this is more of a novelistic approach as far as the subject matter, but still, the content, it's along the lines of what I guess they call fact and fiction. In other words, you take the facts, the details, and you weave them into a fictional story of the various things that go on, in this case, in the jungles of war-torn Africa. And basically, you know, that's nothing new. We've got all kinds of struggles and things in the modern real world of modern Africa in different countries. It just seems as though that's part of the world, one of the parts of the world that seems to struggle through. But you basically have put together an interesting narrative as well. And I'm curious as to the point at which you began your own search, your own quest, if you will. We all can, I can tell you when mine began, maybe not exactly the date, but I know how old I was when I began searching myself. So tell me about the beginnings of your quest.
Well, my quest began at the end of a 10-year period of great illness. Started out just not feeling well one day, and 10 years later, still ill, but you know, had progressively descended down to my deathbed, basically. So I was very sick for a very long time, and the thing about that fact is that nobody could diagnose what was wrong with me. No one. Normally, people speculate and guess, even if they don't know. But with this illness, nobody even tried to speculate as to what was wrong with me. I saw every complementary healthcare practitioner you could imagine, every medical doctor imaginable. In the end, I was just seeing professors at universities, and nobody knew what was wrong with me. But I was very ill and had, you know, multiple terrible symptoms, and as I say, you know, in the end, I was just receiving deathbed counseling to give you an idea of the state I was in. And finally, I met a man on the street, literally, who got talking to me and maintained that he knew exactly what was wrong with me. Not only did he tell me what he knew what was wrong with me, he relayed to me, conveyed to me what my symptoms and condition and situation was just so accurately that I absolutely knew without a doubt that he knew what he was talking about. And, you know, also that it was true that what he maintained was that he had had the same illness himself. And he said to me very persuasively that what I had to do was stop following every prescription I was following, because although nobody knew what was wrong with me, everyone had a prescription for how I should be living and what I should be doing about my situation. And so he was saying very categorically that I should just give up everything I was being told, everything I was every regimen I was following, and that I should immediately begin eating red meat, which I'd cut out of my diet. He said I should start having a few glasses of white wine with my meals. I should have coffee, a couple of cups of coffee a day, and a few cigarettes. I should smoke a few cigarettes every day, and that this would very quickly cure me. And the thing is about my condition is the hundreds of healers and practitioners, healthcare professionals that I'd been to see, none of them knew what was wrong with me, but I can guarantee you not one of them would have agreed with that prescription. Every one of them would have agreed that that would be a death sentence for me in the state I was in. But nevertheless, I had some kind of faith in this person, and also I was just so sick and tired of my situation and hanging on to life and that. And so I just decided I was going to try this. I thought, what the hell? I'll just go out giving myself a bit of pleasure and you know, have a bit of meat and enjoy a steak and enjoy some wine and a few cigarettes. And it was almost like, you know, having a cigarette before the firing squad. But, you know, the thing is, Richard, that very quickly, I mean, within days, I bounced back to health. I had no memory. You know, my memory was shot. In days, my memory came back. I could remember everything again. I had energy again. And you know, certainly 90% of my health was restored within a week, and the other 10% followed in about a month. Now, the interesting thing about this is that I never, ever concluded or believed that there was any efficacy in the actual substances that he had advocated. The thing that dawned on me, the thing that struck me, was that there must be some kind of way in which we focus on things in life that then determines the outcomes in our lives, that determines, you know, our reality, our experience of life. Because for 10 years, I had been just absolutely focused on getting well, actually focused on the fact that I was sick and trying to get well, focused on the fact that nobody could help me, focused on the fact that there was no hope in sight, and, you know, just desperately, especially in the end, clinging on to life, trying to survive. And then, you know, when I just let go of all that and just surrendered and let go of that focus and preoccupation and, in a sense, focused on some sense of the first sense of hope that I'd ever been given and, you know, also just having some pleasure in my life, suddenly everything changed. And I don't know if it was, in that instance, the correct thing to conclude, but it's something I very strongly and definitively concluded that there must be this principle, that there must be some way in which our focus creates your reality. Now, I didn't understand how it worked, but I made it my, you know, my purpose in life to discover more about how this principle worked and how I could use it self-consciously to create more of what I wanted, because I so staggeringly had created the very opposite, the suffering that I didn't want. I thought, and I knew in my heart, that if I understood this principle, I could use it to create the exact opposite. I could use it to create as much joy and happiness and prosperity in my life as I had created misery.
You know, it's interesting that we seem to be making that one shift. And again, there's nothing wrong with, you know, going after one's own personal goals and desires, hopes and dreams and so forth. But I'm hearing more and more, William, that we're starting to make that turn, if you will, to realize that we're not giving up our own personal best, if you will, but that we're now saying, you know, I need to do this for everyone. I need to do this so that others, I mean, we even with this program, you know, I certainly want those better ways of living, not just for me, but for everyone.
Absolutely. And that's why one of the things I determined was that not only would I come to understand this principle for myself, but that I thought, in fact, I didn't realize that there was a worldwide movement appreciating and applying the very principle that I had stumbled across. I thought it was a new insight that nobody else had. And one of my ambitions was, one of my intentions anyway, was to bring this to the awareness of everyone and for the benefit of everyone. And it's interesting what you say, because I totally agree with you, Richard, that we're really moving away from an era where it's just about me, 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 me. And that's why, the metaphor of shamanism is a beautiful metaphor. And one of the metaphors that I love about shamanism, if you think about it, the shaman was the member of society in indigenous cultures who served the whole society. More than anybody else, the shaman in the tribe was dedicated to the welfare of the whole community, and in fact was not so dedicated to their own welfare. In fact, they would often suffer deprivation so that their community could thrive. And really historically, if there was something bad going on, like long-term droughts or something like that, often the shaman would be sacrificed so that the good times could roll again, not that's what we want, but as I say, as a metaphor, the shaman's a beautiful metaphor for the collective benefit and good and highest good of all.
Well, I know that, as I say, we're starting to get that message. We're starting to understand that there is more to life than just us as individuals. And again, I'm not advocating that we give that up. That isn't really the point. It's beginning to realize that we're all in this together. We are all connected. That message seems to be resonating more and more with more and more people around the world. And so it always behooves us to sort of get our own personal house in order. What is it? The first rule of survival, take care of number one. And that's absolutely true, because if you don't take care of you, how are you going to help someone else? So now we're seeking out the healing. We're seeking out the recovering from a lot of childhood stuff that we've had. And you have a program that people can find out about as well. And it's called Living from Greatness. And I'm wondering about how this program came about.
Well, it was a follow-on from my exploration of the whole idea that our focus does create our reality, and that we can actually learn to harness that, learn to master that principle, and basically, it is exactly that. It's learning to differentiate between what I'd call our egoic orientation, where we're, living a life that is driven by, quite unconsciously, in fact, by our belief system, so that we all, and I think it's commonly accepted that we all have limiting beliefs. We take on in our formative years, we take on limiting beliefs that then we're actually quite unconscious of, really. And those limiting beliefs then create an orientation whereby what our orientation in life becomes about is about compensating for those beliefs of any kind of inadequacy or feelings of not being enough or not capable or not being safe, whatever our core belief systems are, and primary beliefs and secondary beliefs, whatever they are. And though we don't know it, though people don't know it, largely what they're doing is living out a compensating tendency. And the problem is, with living out a compensating tendency, you can actually succeed in your compensation, but really what you're doing is you're limiting your life to a very narrow focus that isn't really born of any truth. It's actually just born of your limitations and fears. And so what you're doing then, because that's where the power is, and because what you resist persists, you then perpetuate that. And no matter what you do in terms of personal development or spiritual development, you will always fall back and re-experience your patterned way of life. As one interviewer the other day referred to it as the merry-go-round. You just, you know, you feel like you're going forward, and I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this, because I speak to a lot of people, and they do. Is you have great moments of insight and clarity and power, and then you fall back and you wonder what happened, and you find yourself in the same relationship problem, you find yourself in the same financial pattern, whatever it is, and you go, well, there are times where you realize I'm not really going forward that much. I'm not breaking out of this merry-go-round. I'm not breaking out of this pattern. And, you know, that whole pattern is simply born out of our orientation, our unconscious preoccupation to resolve our beliefs, to compensate for them. And so there's another way, though. There's a creative orientation. There's a soul-inspired orientation where you learn to know thyself and discover and realize what it is that you've been acting in favor of, what your compensating tendencies are, and you can move beyond that. You learn to move beyond that and act in favor of your higher truth, of actually what it is you love, end results that are born free of your circumstances, free of your feelings and your beliefs about life and fears and insecurities about life, so that you can actually, you know, have true power, which in my book, true power is the ability to go directly for what you love. In the other orientation, you're always trying to accumulate things so that in having those things, whether it's wealth or security or image or just whatever it is, then you believe you can then, once you've got all those things, have what you want. But this orientation, the creative, the spiritual, the soul-inspired orientation is one where you don't go for things that will get you something. You go directly for the end result of what really matters to you, the discovery of your heart and what's really true for you to have and true to go for. And the thing is that when you serve that orientation, when you live in that way of life, then you, in a sense, like you were saying, Richard, you do put yourself first. You put your truth first and you go for that. But at that level, we are all connected, and not just we, but we're connected to everything through time and space. I mean, there's a great shamanic principle that survived to today that we realize is a great truth that is expressed in movies and our modern mythology, like the movie Avatar, where it's about the oneness of all. And because we're one, when we serve our truth, when we serve what is highest for us to go for in life, that is connected to the highest good of everything else. You cannot go for your heart and be separate from anything else. Your heart, our hearts are connected. And so it is an act of great service to our community, to our service, to our environment, to transcend ourselves, you know, and live from greatness. And so that's what this program is all about, is transferring from the egoic orientation, the compensating for belief kind of orientation, to the going for your heart, living the soul-inspired orientation.
I think that one of the things that we're striving for as well, and correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe you can address how this ties into what you've just speaking to, and that is moving from belief to knowing. We don't have to believe certain things anymore, because now we know them.
I totally agree. You won't find any disagreement from me there. You see, the old orientation really is one of belief, is one of needing a sense of fixedness and certainty and born of our need for control, actually. And in that orientation, what we're trying to do is we're trying to work things out, we're trying to understand, we're trying to cope, really. We're trying to control ourselves and our environment, and we actually seek certainty. But the problem is that when we seek certainty, when we, as I would say, seek safety, the part of us that is seeking that is the rational part of our mind. And the problem is that the rational part of our mind, the rational linear part of our mind that seeks to understand, that seeks to cope, etc., doesn't relate to the moment and the truth of the moment and what's actually going on now, and it doesn't make the connections that are there to be made and see through to the possibilities are there, that are there to be seen. It actually goes backwards in time and looks at our past, looks at our experience, and actually dredges up our belief systems. And we love that at some level because that's what we've held on to forever and we're familiar with and we feel comfortable with. It's like in the Hobbit, J.R. Tolkien refers to hobbits as little people who like to read books full of things they already know about. And I'm pretty sure he's actually describing human nature there, or the lower side of human nature, because that's us and our belief systems, what we like to cling to. And so if we mean to move on to a soul-inspired way of living and come to, you know, our genius, everybody has genius. Genie, after all, means spirit, and we all have pure creative spirit. We all have genius, but it doesn't reside in our rational framework. It resides outside of that, and so we arrive at our soul-inspired way of seeing awareness and seeing the world by softening our focus, letting go of our need to so badly understand and work out. And the thing is, when we go into innocence and we don't need to know, the paradox is it's not an empty place. It's not a disorientated place. It's actually full of powerful information, a place where we are inspired, where our genius resides, and we become very creative. We become very wise. We make the connections that we don't normally see. We see the possibilities that we don't normally see. Because we rise up like eagles and have the eagle eye view of the forest.
Let me ask you about your own particular belief systems as you have grown and followed your quest and followed your heart and soul and lived an on-purpose life and so forth, and obviously written these books that are now available to our listeners. From where do you... From where do you hail spiritually, can we say?
Oh, I mean, that's a very easy to answer. It's a very easy question to answer. Basically, you see, once I made the realization that I made that there's something about the way in which we focus that creates our reality, and once I made the intention to understand that better, it's like with anything, Richard, and you would appreciate that, and I'm sure anyone listening will appreciate this. It's uncanny how when we make serious intentions, suddenly, you know, the world conspires to, you know, create the resources and the synchronicities and the, you know, circumstances that then facilitate that intention. And that's what happened to me. I mean, I had no understanding of any of this material until I made the realization I made and I made the intention that I made. And once I made that intention, suddenly, you know, teachings came out of the woodwork, and I was led to very powerful teachings in relation to this principle and this subject. And for me also, I think it's just part of my nature and what suited me best. And, you know, because I was attracted to something, and the teachings that came to me were very related to something in specific, which was alchemy, the teachings of alchemy and the modern-day application of alchemy. And specifically within that, the Hermetic philosophy, which is kind of, you know, many scholars refer to as the alchemy par excellence. It's you know, just the cream of alchemy. And what it has to do with is the turning lead into gold, as everyone knows, as a cliche or as a metaphor. But it's you know, within that, what it really is about shifting from that egoic orientation to that soul-inspired creative orientation. And basically, more than any of my books, The Last Shaman is a manual, if you like, is a guide in this process. And what I love about alchemy is that many of the models that are out there that, you know, being taught relating to personal and even spiritual development are still very mentally based. It's still offering models for understanding and working life out. Whereas with alchemy, with Hermetic philosophy, it's a very powerful creative model that I use and other people use to very powerful effect. Like, for instance, my books, I've never ever been trained in writing, and I don't have any education to speak of, anything like that. And yet I've used these principles to write my books and been very richly rewarded in every sense. I mean, the Magician's Way, my first book, which The Last Shaman is a sequel to, was the best-selling metaphysical book ever in Australia, and that rewarded me very handsomely, both in terms of book sales and then the seminar business that it led to, and also the satisfaction of all the people that it helped, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about what I love about Hermetic philosophy and alchemy, especially, is that it's not an intellectual framework. It's not a conceptual framework. It's a model for engaging your creative spirit and having your genius, having your spirit, having your natural ability come in to support you and take over and create your life in a way that you could never, ever hope to work out, you know, through any mental approach and formulaic approach whatsoever.
Well, it's, to me, quite an extraordinary experience for each one of us when we take on that role to become more. And that's really what it kind of comes down to, is that we've achieved an awful lot in our lives, depending upon how you measure that. And is what we have achieved really is it really satisfying? And
exactly,
I think that's what a lot of people are beginning to realize as well. Whether you're just, you know, an ordinary individual such as myself, or maybe somebody who's been in the money trades, you know, the economic businesses, you know, who's bought and sold, in some instances, stuff that doesn't really exist, but you've managed to find a way to buy and sell it, and it's been very lucrative for you. But now you're beginning to realize that this just isn't really what this just is. I'm not at peace. I'm not centered. I'm agitated. I'm unsettled, et cetera, et cetera. And I know that there's something more, but I can't leave this thing, because if I do, I'm going to lose all of that stuff. But I think the realization is coming, William, that they're beginning to realize that, you know what, that stuff doesn't matter anymore. It's like, okay, I can have three times what I have today, and I still won't be at peace. I still won't be centered. I still won't be living on purpose.
Exactly. I mean, it's, you know, you're talking about your story. You're talking about my story. That's what I used to do. You know, mm-hmm. I used to be in the money markets and the financial markets and trade futures and, you know, non-existent instruments, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
And the thing is I was very good at that. You know, I was up to a point very good at fulfilling what I call societal expectations, making money, having the house, having the beautiful wife, having everything that basically society up until very recently held out as what we should be aspiring to and acquiring and competing with each other to have. And, you know, looking back on it, I know now that the illness that I had was a spiritual illness, it was a sickness of soul, because that life just took me so far from what was true for me. And what not only was true for me, but that had anything to do with my gifts and talents, my true gifts and talents in the world, and my contribution. And, you know, the thing is that we're really living in a time where I really believe we now feel it so strongly. I think there were times before where you could live off purpose, and I think a lot of people did, and without consequence. But now, you know, things are opening up so much more, and we're just becoming so much more connected.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, just things are opening up some, and I just see it in so many people. It's like what you're saying, Richard. It's just not enough to selfishly strive for material gain on its own.
Yeah.
It actually gives us nothing. And, you know, I take people to Africa every year on safari. And I run a couple of safaris over there. We call them soul safaris. And the thing that strikes people and really helps them more than anything else is to meet impoverished people in, you know, in the wildest situations without anything. People in the most negated circumstances who yet are such beautiful people and are so happy. And, you know, you come across these people and everyone in your group's freaking out because their camera lens has, you know, been lost or something like that, you know, and they're thinking about some stock that's gone badly for them back home. And but, you know, they live in mansions and that, and they look at these people and go, it's a slap in the face. It's like, my God, what's wrong with me?
Yeah.
When these people are living in bliss and living in joy, and they got nothing, and I got everything, and I'm so discontented. And it's not that we people should live in bliss, should live in poverty and that to attain bliss and that, but it's just instructional on what's important in life and what matters in life.
Mm-hmm.
And what matters in life is that we are in touch with our hearts, that we, you know, we know what really matters to us, and that we use the gifts that we've been given personally, and that we make a contribution to what we're a part of through what we do and, you know, what we practice. And when we do that, well, somehow then we're richly rewarded materially and spiritually, and we live our bliss, we live our joy, and then we really know what it means to be wealthy, to be abundant.
The Magician's Way is one book. The latest is The Last Shaman, and the website is williamwhitecloud.com. We're going to continue with our interview here with William Whitecloud here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Tell me your story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are working towards understanding one another and beginning to realize that we are all interconnected, if you will, and that's really what we're talking about here. One of the things that came to mind, William, as you were sharing your stories of your soul safaris, in terms of our letting go of our materialistic mentality, is I saw myself standing in a giant meadow. And when you went to the African safaris, the soul safaris, I thought, wow, we're kind of in sync here. My first thought was, okay, if I am one of these animals on the African plain and I'm in this giant meadow of grasses, and that's fine for me, but I'm looking at it going, you know, this is great. I've got plenty to eat here. I can never eat it all. See, boy, I'd love to. I should have a bunch of friends over, you know, and we can share this meadow, that kind of thing. And I think that it's not so much getting rid of all of the things that we have, although there's, you know, there is certainly room to talk about that as well. But it's more the mentality. It's more the attitude and the perspective of the need to acquire them for some socially misgotten concept or theory that these things will bring me what it is that I really want. And You talk about these people that go with you on these soul safaris, and they start worrying about the little things like the lens cap and stocks and all of these different things, and yet they live in these incredible homes in other parts of the world. And I have to wonder if folks are going to begin the process at that level of saying, you know what, I really don't need all of this. I'm going to shift. And again, we're not talking, as you said, we're not talking about people going into poverty. But one of the things I've noticed, please help me to understand this. One of the things that I have noticed with all of the documentaries that I have seen about the various peoples in Africa, they're always wearing such brightly colored clothes. Now, has that been done exclusively for the cameras and the documentaries, or do they actually, yet they live in such what we define as poverty, they're dressed so brightly, so cheerily.
That's right. Well, they are. I mean, and you know, they're a bright bunch of people. They're very lively. They love color, and they love music, and they love rhythm, and they love to dance, and they love to sing, and you know, they just have beautiful hearts. This is the thing that I love taking people to Africa for, is so that people can really get what it's like to be in a society of people that are so, you know, just so free and joyous. And the thing is that the problem with, you know, if I can say, with Western society as I understand it, is that and this is a really foundational thing for people to get, Richard, is that the problem is, and until you address this problem, you're not really going to go anywhere. And the day that you do address this problem is you're going to be liberated and empowered in a way like you cannot believe. The thing is that we pure creative spirit, in a sense, if you want to look at it like that, that who we are, in essence, is pure creative spirit, connected to everything through all time and space. What our true condition truly is that we're connected, we're one with everything. But to be here, we have to have an individual experience of existence. So we've got to create separation, and we create that separation by forming beliefs. And if you look at any belief that you care to look at, what it amounts to just simply is that you're separate. It's an idea of separation that helps you have a sense of separation and experience life as an individual. But the drawback of that is that then you're walking around feeling like you're separate, and, you know, possibly separate from your worth, separate from your capability, separate from your safety, depending on what your nature is and your personality type is and the belief that you established. And so what it is that what you'll see is people constantly trying to compensate for this. And the more they compensate for it, the more power they give it, and the more of a sense of emptiness they'll create. And in the West, we have masterfully adopted strategies and created strategies for, you know, ending the separation or taking action towards it. We've got a lot of material things and activities that we can pursue and material things that we can collect, all in the hope of fulfilling us and completing us. But the trouble is that the more we accumulate from that orientation anyway, is the less satisfied we are, because we realize, oh, we've made, I mean, I've seen this in people. I know, and to a lesser extent with myself, I've seen friends of mine make $2 million and then go, and they dreamed about being worth $2 million. And when they became worth $2 million, they went, you know what, $20 million will do it. And when they made $20 million, they went, you know what, $200 million will do it. Mm-hmm. And the gap just gets bigger. The emptiness just grows.
Mm-hmm.
And what the people in Africa have got, who've got nothing, is they're not trying to get that. It's not what they're preoccupied with in life. So they don't have a sense so strongly that they're empty, that they're missing something, that they're separate, that they're lacking in something. Now, when we can come back to the definition of ourselves, the true insight into ourselves, and I'm just talking about the truth here, is when we can just come back to the truth that we are whole, that we are complete, that we have everything, then something entirely different happens to us. Then the peace of the power of now, then the the satisfaction with life, the peace and the serenity comes back to us, the sense of fulfillment. And now we complete, we whole. And the thing is that from that space, we don't have to act in favor of resolving our tension of separation, of being incomplete, being unsafe, whatever it is. What occurs to us in that place of wholeness is our passion and what we love. And then we go about expressing that, and that has a positive cycle where the more we express what we love and what we're passionate about, the happier we are, and the more we want to express that. And so we go into a different kind of cycle, whereas in the other cycle, we're in a vicious downward spiral of emptiness. In the other cycle, we're in this upward cycle spiral where we're just creating more and more passion, more and more joy, more and more bliss. And like you say, with the Africans that you see in documentaries and that, the bright color, the music, the dancing, the laughter, the life, and it's very real. I come from Africa, and I take people there, and I'm there all very often. And, you know, Africans, in many ways, I love them because they personify that orientation.
It's real interesting to have conversations with folks about our own economy and the global economy and the challenges that face us. And then you come on the program and we start talking about other folks in other parts of the world that we don't focus a lot of attention on. I've noticed that the only time that we put the spotlight on any of the countries in Africa, the continent of Africa, is when there are skirmishes you want to do a documentary or what have you on the animals, the native animals of say the Serengeti Plains or what have you. It doesn't seem as though, and if I'm not mistaken, isn't there a place in Africa that is considered to be sort of the seed or seat of civilization, the cradle of civilization? I know that I've heard Baghdad. I've heard that some parts of the Middle East are considered to be that. But I've also heard it said that there was some place in Africa somewhere.
Well, originally it was thought of as East Africa as being the cradle of civilization where the oldest remains of human beings were found. But that's only because Louis Leakey, who was looking for them, was in East Africa. And so his digging found the oldest remains that had been found up until then. But there's no doubt that the African Rift Valley, which runs from, you know, northeast Africa down the eastern side of Africa all the way down to South Africa, has to be the cradle of civilization. But now the most ancient remains that have been found have been found much further south, in fact down in South Africa. And the farm that I grew on, up on, believe it or not, the farm I grew up on in Swaziland is where the second or third oldest remains ever have been found. And the thing is that when you go and you stand on that land, it's just absolutely remarkable. You can just feel it. Nobody has to tell you. Like I was saying, I take people back to Africa. I take them back to my old farm even. And they stand on that land, and I don't preempt it with anything. I don't tell them anything about it. And yet when they stand on that land, they just become awestruck, and they look at me and they go, this is just amazing energy to be standing here. It just feels so ancient. It feels like where I come from. And that's the point where I just break into a smile and I say, you know what it is? You're standing on the second or third oldest site of human, you know, evidence of human habitation ever.
This whole subject of not only where we've come from and where we are, but where we're going to, a lot of people are, that's their biggest question right now. Where are we going as a people, as a civilization? And they're not speaking specifically and exclusively of, say, the United States or any given country. They're asking this question overall of all of us. Where are we going? Have you had an answer for that?
No, you know, I don't, because I'm not saying that it's wrong to be. I think it's a valid preoccupation. But it really doesn't concern me, to be honest, Richard. The thing that I'm very interested in for myself is just what's my truth, where am I heading, and you know, anybody that I'm in touch with and that I work with, what I want to empower them is, you know, who are they, and what's calling them, what's heading, where are they heading? If there's anywhere that we're heading collectively, I believe, is towards a cohesive society. I think in the past we've lived in a very, directed way where, you know, there's been authorities up at the top who have then dictated to everyone else where we're going, what's happening. And, you know, there can be a way in which people are still, even though that model is dying, people are still kind of in some way a little addicted to it and need that outer direction to, you know, to have a sense of orientation in life. But also, yet when they get the outer orientation, they're not satisfied with it. People don't like anymore, the authority telling them how it is and how it should be. And I think where we actually going, and I'm totally at peace with this. I think it's a beautiful idea, is for each of us to know for ourselves, to not look and try and understand the big picture metaphysically, but just because also it's just, you know, it's just a waste of energy in the sense that it's taking the attention off yourself and your responsibility to know thyself and know what's true for you and you know, where you're going to go. And as I was saying before, if everybody just took responsibility, or if a large number of people just take responsibility for themselves and know for themselves what's true for them and create that in life, well, that's going to create the weave that takes us to the next level as a community, as a society. And it'll do that in the most powerful way, rather than all of us trying to work out where it is. And then once we've worked out where it is, go there. The problem, as I said, is in that whole, it's an old orientation. It's the egoic orientation. Part of the old masculine egoic structures is this thing of needing to know what it's all about, like 2012. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everyone going, well, this is going to happen in 2012, and this is what it's about. And it's just the rational part of us trying to make sense of things. And when we're in that need to know and be orientated, again, you know, as I say, the problem is that we just then referring to the side of ourselves that references our belief systems, whether unconsciously and very subtly, nevertheless, that's what it's doing. And we just we don't escape the treadmill that we're on. The best way to escape the treadmill we're on is just to let go and allow and receive and not project. And, you know, my book, The Last Shaman, is very much about learning a process and coming to a way of life whereby you recognize that you're being guided in life and beginning to live life by following your guidance. Mm. And it's like working for the CIA when you live a life of following your guidance. You don't know too far ahead what's happening. You live in the moment and know moment by moment your truth and act on that. And the beauty of that is that you live in a way where things unfold and you look back, you know, retrospectively and go and you marvel what has unfolded.
Well, I can certainly appreciate and understand that analogy as far as working for the CIA, and I can honestly say that for the better part of my life, I've been very fortunate to be able to say that I've been, for the most part, in the right place at the right time. Didn't plan it that way. I didn't set out a roadmap to be at these different points along the path. It's just that when I got there, it was like, oh, look at what's happening. This is very interesting. This is kind of fun. I'm enjoying this. And again, being in the right place at the right time, almost it just became natural.
But the thing about that is for you, I'm sure you can agree with me then, that for you who find yourself in the right place at the right time, and live in that wonder and awe that that must engender, where you go, wow, I'm in the right place and the right time. I can relate to that too. And the thing about that synchronicity, Richard, you surely you must agree, it's not born of planning and working things out. Because when you plan and work things out, you know, your rational mind's going to keep you on a track that's going to be way off the track of synchronicity and serendipity.
Isn't it the phrase that when man makes plans, God laughs?
Yeah, man proposes and God disposes.
I honestly have to truly wonder how we can, and I'm not even sure how to put this, William, but how we can make that shift so that we don't get bogged down in the details. We live in the moment, we enjoy where we are, such as you've described the folks in Africa on the safaris and so forth. But at the same time, we understand that yes, we want something different.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, thank you for the very, you know, powerful and succinct insight into our economic history, because, you know, that's the way it's been, and that's what I refer to as societal expectations. You see, is that just what society wanted of us in our lifetime, going back over the last few hundred years, is to be consumers. It all depended on us consuming and creating a new consumers in undeveloped countries, building in obsolescence into our products, and it's just so that we work to buy, and because we have to buy, we've got to work, and that's that treadmill that we're on. And as you say, totally unsustainable, and guess what? The whole world in absolute financial shock at the moment, because the unsustainability of that cycle of that model has been reached, and it's just absolutely unsustainable. And I look at my kids, and you know, I look at your niece, your great niece, and you go, well, what sort of future are they going to have? Are they going to be on the same treadmill? Well, they're not. I don't know what treadmill, I don't know what paradigm they're going to be in.
Yeah,
it's going to be up to us and them and the future generations to create a new model, because my kids aren't going to be living off the old model. They can't. It can't sustain them. And as long as we try and sustain that model, it's just going to get worse for everybody and become more and more unsustainable. And I really do believe that you don't have to worry about it, Richard. It's everybody can take care of the problem by taking care of their own destiny, because we're all connected. If I get on with focusing on myself and in the sense of myself, in this sense, what's true for me to focus on and get on with and create and contribute in my life, what I love, then I'm going to fulfill myself. But I'm also, because I'm connected, I'm also going to contribute to the welfare of my environment and my society. And, you know, I strongly believe that where we have to go from now, and, you know, I don't have dates and I don't have eras and I don't have names for these things, but I do know what the future looks like or has to look like, really, is that, let me put it this way, what we're being forced to do as individuals and as a society is go to a whole new orientation, and it is an orientation that is driven, that it will be and is and will be driven by everybody doing what they love. And as I said before, I use the term a cohesive society. That's where, rather than a few people at the top dictating to the people down below how it is and how it's going to be, everyone contributes and contributes to how they want it to look and what they'd love it to be and do what they love. And then in that way, then magically everything coming together to fall into place for the whole society and the benefit of everybody involved. And it's just a new level of consciousness, basically, that we have to come to and rely on, rather than the old sort of, as I say, directive, linear style of organizing ourselves and our society.
Well, it's an equation that, you know, I know a lot of people have looked at, and then there have been those who've looked at it and said, hey, this can't continue to work, and then they're accused of being, you know, anti-capitalism or anti-American or what have you. And it's like, well, wait a minute. You know, you say this is the greatest country in the world. Well, let's make it so. Let's take a realistic look at basic, simple math. See, this is the thing that's always struck me about economics. They made it really complicated so that you had to go to school to learn what in the world they were doing. But then again, I have to wonder if they really know what they're doing because, well, gee, look what happened in 2008. But all of this began long before 2008. It's an interesting situation that we find ourselves in. There's no question about it. And the word hero, William, has been used to describe those of us who are here today living through these challenges. Would you make a similar assessment of those of us who have chosen to be here?
I would use the same term. I mean, I love the term hero and the whole idea of the hero's journey, which I was introduced to through Joseph Campbell, and I'm sure many of us have been introduced to through Joseph Campbell. And, you know, Joseph Campbell defines a hero as anybody who acts in something, in service of something higher than just themselves, and, you know, for a greater good, for a higher purpose. And I believe myself that today's heroes are not war heroes or corporate heroes, but heroes of consciousness, people that are really taking the trouble to listen to themselves, to know themselves, and to know what their true path is for themselves and to follow that. And, you know, I just believe that the problems that we face today have been created by a mindset that, you know, just cannot solve those problems. We've got to go out of the mindset that created the problems. And the mindset that we really have to orientate towards is a heroic mindset where we, instead of orientating on our problems and what's wrong and trying to fix everything within ourselves or societally, let go of that fixing orientation, mm-hmm. and just take it back to the individual, take it back to yourself, and just ask yourself, what is it that you love? What is that matters to you? And it's a whole new orientation, and it's a heroic orientation because, you know, the mind immediately goes, yeah, but what about the problems? You know, we're not going to be viable unless we address what's wrong, unless we address what's broken, what's not working. But in trying to address that, we in focusing on the problem, we'll just always perpetuate it because the answers that we'll come up with will always in some way be related to the answers or that originally created the problem. And so to break out of that, we have to go back within ourselves and, you know, just ask ourselves individually, what is it that matters to us? What is our path? What do we love? And put our attention on that and focus on that and take action towards that. And then, as I said before, you know, what you find miraculously, and it is, it's like a miracle, it's magical, that when you engage in that orientation, you do become enriched yourself. You do become fulfilled yourself. But always at the same time, you will always serve the bigger picture. You will always serve the whole. And if there are just more people doing that, it would be the best way of, you know, fixing our problems in our world, going to a new way, a better way of life and of living.
Well, we are all encouraged by many of the things that we're seeing these days as far as the changes that have been unfolding. People who have been standing up and speaking out and saying enough is enough. We don't want this anymore. We want something different. I often use the example of the Occupy movement that gets criticized because they don't really have any focus. And I said, well, actually, they do. They have they're pretty darn focused. They're basically tired of the way things are, and they want things to change. Now, whether they are the group that's going to initiate that change or come up with the ideas isn't really relevant. But the fact is that people are starting to stand up and say that, William. They're starting to say, enough is enough. This is not the way that I want to live anymore. And this program is designed to hopefully bring about some of those ideas. I don't have the ideas for the new ways of living. I'm seeking people such as yourself, William, for those new ways. You know, you are the, so to speak, the euphemistic guru, if you will, who we will go to and say, hey, what is your suggestion? What are your ideas? What are your concepts? And you've given us an awful lot to think about in this program. And I want to thank you so much for taking so much time to share with us. Let me ask you, who is William Whitecloud?
Who is William Whitecloud? William Whitecloud is a human being who is living on planet Earth for the last 57 years and who has, you know, really come to understand himself as a multidimensional being who, you know, beyond the body and mind that he occupies, understands himself as being a spirit who is actually so much more than that and who is connected to all the other spirits on this planet and who is one with everything and who exists to appreciate and receive that connection every day, and particularly in those that I come into contact with, principally my family and my friends and then all those who I meet and learn from and teach. And I am, you know, someone very dedicated to sharing my experience of self and of life with others so that they can come to know themselves and appreciate themselves at the deepest levels that it is possible to receive, appreciate, and understand themselves and experience themselves as well.
Well, I'm also curious as to what it is that, though, and again, when I ask this question, you've spent the last hour sort of answering it, but I'm going to hone it down and have you just address it directly. What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing?
Well, firstly, you know, through the work that I'm doing, one of the things is that, you know, we have this saying that a teacher teaches what they need to learn. And everything I've been talking about, we've been talking about this last hour, is something I continually need reinforcing. It's not just something that I have just learned and it's like a magic bullet and I'll have it forever. So through teaching this work, I actually keep myself on the path. I keep myself open-minded and I keep myself true to the principles, and I keep myself learning the principles and receiving new insights all the time. And I just absolutely love the path I love. And also, what I hope to achieve is to make a contribution to the world and to society and to specifically to individuals. And I do so all the time. It gives me great satisfaction when I get a letter from a teenager who was suicidal and wanted to kill themselves, and their parents gave them, say, the magician's way, and they write to me and say that they wanted to kill themselves and they read the book and they found new hope and realization, and now actually life's great, and they're just writing to thank me for that. And so, you know, therein lies my fulfillment and my reward, is I've done my job whenever I get feedback like that.
Well, we encourage you to continue the work that you are about, and to hopefully share with us in the months ahead how it's going and what you are observing as the changes continue. And it's to me quite an extraordinary time in which to live. I kind of think about that one phrase about history. And that unless we learn from the lessons of history, that we are, as they say, doomed to repeat history. But I have a feeling that a lot of folks, whether they know of it or not, they know that the way we're going is not the right way to go, not the correct way. Matter of fact, there was a friend of mine who will have on the program in the coming months, he says he never tells people that something is right or wrong. It's either correct or incorrect. He's being very, very specific in terms of the words that he uses, especially considering when you say the word right, that word itself is so charged energetically with other things. So he uses the word correct. So we're looking for the correct, the correct path, so to speak. And I think we'll find it together. I want to thank you, William Whitecloud, for joining us on the program and for your book, The Last Shaman. WilliamWhiteCloud.com is the website. He's also written The Magician's Way. And again, thank you, William, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Richard. And it's been a very interesting and, I'd even say fun conversation.
Well, I'm glad. We want this to be fun. We don't want it to be hard. The next interview is going to be hard. I save that for someone else. But again, I thank you so much. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next Saturday at this same time, love to Lal.